All right, next week is Constitution Week in America. So we're going to go back to the summer of 1787. That's quite some time ago. That was when a group of Americans, right, ragtag Americans, gathered in Philadelphia. We had just won the Revolutionary War. We've been operating as a series of states under the Articles of Confederation. So back in 1787, there were some problems that they were trying to deal with. They got together to maybe revise the Articles of Confederation. Then they thought, well, you know what? This is bigger. And what they did indeed was big. Much bigger, I think, than they even imagined. We've got a system of government here that works if we can make it work, right? All the pieces are there. We're going to get into the Constitution today because those questions that they were answering in 1787, there's still questions that we wrestle with today. State Senator Tom McGillivray is in studio. Rob Nadelson, constitutional scholar, by phone. Today, it is the Constitution, why it was created, what was debated, and how we can still preserve it on Voices of Montana. Welcome aboard. Tom McGillivray is in studio, our state senator, Republican, representing Billings and the Montana Senate, and has been doing that for a number of years. But Tom, I know that you're not up for re-election, so you're kind of trimmed out in that regard, but that's not the way to start the show. Congratulations. Thanks for all of your service. I appreciate that. And you're a lover of the Constitution.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you today, and thanks for having me on, and Rob, too.
Yeah, and Rob Nadelson with us by phone, a constitutional scholar. He's a senior fellow of constitutional jurisprudence at the Mountain States Policy Center. Rob, good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Montana.
Good morning. You know, I really appreciate you having us on, Tom, today, because, you know, a lot of people appreciate the Constitution, but they really don't have a good grasp of it, how it came about. What were the problems that precipitated the Constitutional Convention? You know, it's a short document, but it's not a simple document. You know, obviously, there were 55 individuals, 35 of which were lawyers. That's part of our problem here, to understand it. It was a lot of legal language, antiquated language, 18th century language that sometimes is hard for us to understand. But I also think that it's good for us to understand what were some of the problems that the Articles of Confederation, which was really more like a NATO treaty among the 13 states, what were some of the problems that they were dealing with that precipitated the Constitutional Convention in 1787? So I thought we'd kind of delve into some of those issues and talk about them today, and then some of the big debates that they had during the convention, and you know, how we preserve that document going forward.
Let's launch into that. And I think the thing that's I'm excited about looking at is how they balanced the need, because they just got done fighting a war of oppression, they felt, right?
Yeah.
From England, where they didn't have a voice. So they didn't want to create a government that was going to be the same eventually. But yet also some of the problems that you're talking about, they had to have a government that dealt with that. What were they dealing with?
Yeah, well, one of the big problems with the Articles of Confederation simply was they could not tax, so they couldn't raise revenue. So they had all this debt that was left over from the war, and they frankly could not tax to get revenue to pay the debt. So they basically had to ask states, hey, would you send us some money? You know, based on their land values, at the say to New York, hey, would you send us this much money? Maryland, would you send us this much money? And et cetera. And the states obviously had their own problems and self-interest, and so they didn't send any money. And so, you know, they couldn't raise revenue to pay their debts.
Who was it then? And Rob, we'll go to you after this for some thoughts, too, initially, as these group of characters kind of get together here. But I think about, I mean, every American could be described as a ragtag American back then, so to speak, because we were very raw and very new, but we weren't uneducated about certain things. Who were the characters that were leading this charge? And it divided eventually into two groups, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I think one of the big characters when you're talking about money was Robert Morris. You know, he was one of the only two that signed the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. But he was one of the most wealthy men in America, and he, you know, helped get the war financed, and he was also the chief financial officer, if you will, of the Articles of Confederation. It was his problem to try to raise the money, and obviously they couldn't raise it. So, you know, essentially they had to call a convention to fix that one of that one, that problem, which was a huge problem, can't pay your debts, couldn't play Revolutionary War soldiers, couldn't, you know, raise revenue to do that.
Rob, lean in here on this, the setup for the creating of the Constitution. You know, I hate to think that it was taxes, because it's taxes that sort of started the whole thing, the Revolutionary War, and then resolving the tax issue was a path toward peace, I think, for the states.
Well, I think Senator McGilvery hit the nail on the head when he said that the Articles of Confederation was really just an alliance like NATO today. There's something called the North Atlantic Council, which coordinates NATO defense matters, and the Confederation Congress was really not much more powerful than that. So as Senator McGilvery says, they couldn't raise taxes, but there were other things they couldn't do either. They couldn't regulate commerce. So the British were bringing in large amounts of goods, dumping it in the American market, putting American businesses out of business, and there was no way that the Confederation Congress could regulate that trade or impose tariffs on it. In addition to that, the states got into trade wars with each other. Connecticut and Rhode Island almost came to blows. Rhode Island had been issuing a large amount of paper money, which inflated, and debtors really liked that because they could pay back their debts in worthless paper money. And so the Connecticut people, Connecticut was called the land of steady habits, the Connecticut people, who were often creditors, were being paid off by these Rhode Island debtors in this worthless currency. And so the Connecticut legislature says, from now on, creditors don't have to accept Rhode Island money. Well, the Rhode Island legislature retaliates with a measure which says, anybody who doesn't accept our money, if we catch him, we're going to throw him in jail. So you see these kinds of trade wars arising. In addition to that, Rhode Island, North Carolina, and other states adopted a series of what they call debtor relief measures, which destroyed credit in the country. I mean, nobody would lend money except at exorbitant rates because they weren't sure they could get paid back. Debtors, not just deserving debtors, but any debtors were either given the right to pay back their debts in worthless property, or they were given long periods of time within which to pay back. So the whole credit system of the country was collapsing. And that's one of the things that drew the Constitutional Convention together. One other correction, Tom, it is a common belief that the convention was simply called for amending the Articles of Confederation. That's not really true. The commissions of 10 of the 12 participating states authorized a wider change than that, as did the call of the convention, which came from Virginia.
State Senator.
Add on to that. You know, one of the problems with this, with credit and so forth, was the states were issuing paper money. So what they would actually do is, like, farmers would say, we don't have any hard money. We don't have any specie, like, for example, gold and silver. We're very lacking that. We are land rich. We have assets, but we don't have money. So they would petition their legislatures to issue some paper money, and then they would simply, you know, take their land as collateral, get the paper money, and then try to play a merchant that they own with paper money. But the merchant wouldn't take the paper money, so there was a huge problem because they were fearing that money would depreciate, which it did. And so merchants sometimes would even shut down their shops because they wouldn't take that paper money. Mm. And the bottom line is it led to severe inflation. And as Rob said, you know, you had a huge wealth transfer from creditors to debtors, and that created a lot of resentment and heartache. And as Rob said, you know, you have states nearly coming to blows. So it was not just that the federal government couldn't raise money. States were printing money and created a lot of inflation, and there were trade barriers. For example, New Jersey didn't have ports, so they had to ship stuff through Boston ports or New York ports. And so Boston and New York would charge them duties to be able to ship their merchandise overseas. So there was a lot of resentment between the states, and there's a lot of dysfunction in the states.
This goes, this is going back to 1787. So, you know, this is some 9-10 years or so after the Declaration of Independence. And you could see some of these problems formulate here. There was also no no executive branch to speak of, and no judicial branch to speak of.
There was no president. There was no judicial branch. That were part of the problem they addressed at the Constitution, and the Articles of Confederation didn't allow for that. But the Articles of Confederation also didn't allow for to raise armies. They had no standing army. And I think Shays' Rebellion is a good example of a big problem. So there's Massachusetts farmers that were frustrated. They didn't have money, and Massachusetts passed a law to pay war debt, property tax. So these farmers couldn't pay their taxes. They had no hard money. So they essentially rebelled and wanted to shut down courts so they wouldn't have their farms foreclosed on. And this was a big problem. Washington was very concerned about this. He called the country the Articles of Rope of Sand. In other words, they just couldn't function.
Mm. Okay, let's ask the question about dealing with these problems then. I'm sure there was opposition to creating a larger document, but I think a lot of people saw the necessity of it. What spurred it on? And then let's talk about, did they do the right thing?
Well, as Rob said, you know, all these problems with the Articles of Confederation precipitated the Constitution. So Virginia in 1786 called the convention, basically saying we need to sit down and devise and discuss all alterations and further provisions to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the Union. So as Rob said, it wasn't the Congress that called for this convention. It was the states, Virginia being the first state, and then five other states used similar language to Virginia, saying we've got to come together and devise a method of government which can address these exigencies. Now, you know, we don't really use that term anymore, but it means we've got some emergencies happening. We have kind of like 911, call 911 stat. It's a disaster and the country's going to fall apart. There was concern the Union would dissolve or that there would be sectional rivalries developed. So all these problems were precipitating Virginia to make that call for the convention.
Rob Nadelson, weigh in on that. And then we'll move to, you know, we're creating the foundation for this reason here. And then we'll look at that discussion, so to speak, and how they address some of these problems. But is there more in that background you wanted to just lay out there for us?
Not much more. Yeah. The idea of a wider convention actually occurred at the Annapolis Convention. In September of 1786, five states met together under the leadership of John Dickinson of Pennsylvania and Delaware. And they were brought together for the purpose of trying to come up with some kind of trade deal that all the states could agree on and then might amend the Articles of Confederation. But they said, you know, we need a larger consideration. We need a wider consideration of the political system. So they sent a recommendation to the states that had sent them, one of which was Virginia, saying, we recommend you call a wider convention. And that's what triggered the Virginia legislature on December 1, 1786, to send out a message to the other states saying, let's meet in Philadelphia in next May and see if we can come up with a wider fix.
And I'm curious, there's probably some people out there who already were thinking about that and maybe had some drafts for that that document. We're going to move on to this debate, whether nationalism or federalism, strong central government versus state power. And then I think that still plays out today in our society in a lot of ways. We look at our national debt. I've talked to State Senator Tom McGillivray numerous times about our national debt. And Tom, we still have a national debt,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, we do.
You got to get on that, okay?
40 trillion.
Yeah. Next week, Constitution Week and Constitution Day, September 17th. We have State Senator Tom McGillivray in studio, and also Rob Nadelson is with us. Tom as Senate Majority Leader in this last Montana legislative session, now serving Senate District 26, based out of Billings here as well, had been leadership in the House prior to his leadership in the Senate as well. And we know Rob Nadelson, original host of Voices of Montana many years ago, senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence at the Mountain States Policy Center, was also a candidate for governor in the state of Montana. And I need to write that down, Rob. What was that people's group that you founded? I think it really changed things in Montana.
Oh, Montanans for Better Government.
Yes.
Yeah, it was for about 4 years, 5 years, it was probably the most successful volunteer group in the state.
Yeah, Tom, were you were around.
Oh, obviously. Yeah, I was around, but I was a pup.
And so was I. And so was I. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you guys all for being here, too. Nancy, stand by. We'll get your question. I want to pick up the discussion here, all right? We see a need for creating this constitution. They call a constitutional convention. And then squarely on their plate, I think, Tom, I'll have you address that first, is the issue about how much power do we give our national government, our federal government, so to speak. And if we give it too much power, how do we pull it back if we make that mistake?
Well, that was the big problem they dealt with. You know, we want to be able to make a government big enough to deal with these big problems that we have, but small enough to maintain state sovereignty and state rights. And that was the tension between the Federalist and the Nationalist. You had people like Madison and Hamilton. Some of the things that Madison and Hamilton wanted to do would just blow our minds today. For example, Hamilton wanted the president to serve for life. He wanted the Senate to serve for life. And that was simply non-starters to Federalists. Madison also wanted the federal government to be able to veto any state law and to legislate in all areas, quote-unquote, where the states were incompetent. So obviously these are non-starters to strong states' rights Federalists. And it would be non-starters for us today as states' rights individuals, conservatives. So there was this tension between Federalists and Nationalists. But I would hasten to argue today that most of us are Nationalists. I mean, we fly the American flags. Like, if you go around Billings, and I'm grateful for the patriotism, everybody's flying their American flag. You got your American flag up there. You got your Voices of Montana with the stars up there.
Right.
Just looking around your studio today, Tom, you're a Nationalist. You don't have a Montana flag in here, I don't think.
I've got a Montana Constitution in here,
though. Oh, good for you.
Okay. Yeah.
So you pass. But, you know, everything comes out of Washington, executive orders. The president just said that, hey, we shouldn't have Bombardier doing business in the... Well, what does the president have to do with, you know, a company doing business in this... in the United States.
Right.
So everything flows out of Washington, and we've kind of forgotten about states' rights, so Washington has kind of encroached in all these affairs of states, air, water, agriculture, food law, you know, police powers, family, education, and you could go on, oil, gas, coal. So what they tried to do with the Constitution is have enumerated powers, giving the federal government certain powers and reserving everything else to the states. And these were the major debates they had at the convention and tried to produce a document that honored both states' rights and give the federal government the power to manage these big issues of trade and treaties and money and an army and funding an army and a navy and so forth.
It seems, and then I'll ask Rob after your response, Tom, it seems that... when you create this pathway, so to speak, for nationalism, for a good, solid national government, that you're creating a slippery slope anyway. Do you think that was the case?
Well, I think it was. You know, some people say that the Constitution was inspired, and I'm not going to debate that or dispute it today. Our Constitution is a great, powerful document that survived 240-some years. And it's the best governing document in the world, in my opinion. But it's not a perfect document, and that's why we have Article 5, the ability to amend it. Part of the problem with the Articles of Confederation is it took 100% of the states to amend it. Mm. So they could never amend it. You know, Rhode Island would say no, or New York would say no when they tried to pass a duty to fund the government. And so they could never fix the problems that the Articles of Confederation had. But as we've said... This is what precipitated the convention, and that there was a big debate between nationalists and federalists, and the compromises then came what we have today.
Rob, weigh in here too, and maybe start with that question about no matter what you were going to do, if you gave power to a national government, you've created a slippery slope one way or the other.
That was the fear of the Federalists. Just to explain a little bit here, the word Federalist at the Constitutional Convention didn't have the meaning it has today. Federalist meant advocates of a confederation, of a league of states. Again, something like NATO, okay? The main models that the framers had before them was, on the one hand, a confederation like the Swiss Confederation, or what existed then, the Dutch Confederation, where the central government really acted only on the states. It didn't act on individuals. That was on the one side. The other model they had was a government, say, like that of England, which consisted of counties or shires, but the counties and shires were subject to control by the national government. So those are the two parties, those who wanted a confederal system on the one side, and those who wanted something like England, a national system, on the other side. The compromise they reached has been described by the former Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy as splitting the atom of sovereignty. Yeah. What they did is they adopted an entirely novel system whereby sovereignty began with the people, but sovereignty for some listed or enumerated purposes was given to the federal government, and sovereignty as to all other purposes was left with the states. So this was a new system. It in some ways looked like the de facto federalism that had existed in the British Empire back before 1763, but the theory of it was entirely new. And working out this balance was the biggest single job of the convention. And after the convention became public, the debates in the public over the Constitution centered on this balance of power more than anything else.
So, and it took a year to ratify this. Do you think, and I got maybe a couple of minutes here. Nancy, stand by. We'll try to get to you before the break here, too. Was it a natural slippery slope?
Well, one of the things I want to add here is that maybe we can talk about this after the break is the slippery slope of debt. Now, many of these ratifiers were deeply concerned about the general welfare clause and the ability to tax and borrow money. In other words, borrow money with no limitation. And Patrick Henry spoke to it. Other ratifiers spoke to it. And I think we should talk a little bit about that slippery slope that, you know, they dealt with the ability to raise money, but they didn't truncate the power of the federal government on that ability to raise money.
Nancy, I don't know. Can you get this done in a minute?
Well, I can try. I've got a couple of quick questions here. One on feminism and women's rights, and also on founding fathers and term limits. I don't know if I can do it in a minute.
Yeah. Go.
We'll talk about term limits.
Okay. I want to mention that we just lost Gloria Steinem, who was a great leader of women's rights in the 1960s during the second wave of feminism in our country. And I'd like to know, during the founding of our Constitution, between 1787 and the American Civil War, why women were left out. We seem to have been considered a second-class citizen, baby factories, until, of course, the Civil War.
Okay, term limits.
We started to come out. We started to go into the battlefields and become nurses and be more independent. But it still took until the 1920s for the right to vote. Now, term limits, I want to ask, are controversial even today, but it seems like at one time we had term limits. Washington, 8 years. Jefferson, 10 years. Adams, 12 years. Hamilton, 15 years. So what has happened to the idea of term limits of political figures, elected officials?
Constitution Week next week on Constitution Day, September 17th. We'll actually have a guest in studio, Brian Miller, who is a candidate for the Eastern District House race. And so that's happening. Dan Wilson, who's a candidate for Supreme Court Justice in Montana, will join us in studio the following day on September 18th. In studio now, State Senator Tom McGillivray, who has served the Billings area in the legislature for a number of years in the House of Representatives, a little time off, and then also in the State Senate as well, and eventually in leadership positions. We have talked from time to time, Tom, about term limits and of course, the budget and things like this. Today, we're focusing in on the Constitution. We also have Rob Nadelson, who's with us here, Mountain States Policy Center, and original show host here, we like to say, and created Montanans for a Better Government years ago as well, as he was a professor at the University of Montana. And we have a question from Nancy that we're going to pick up here. And Rob, I think I'll throw this one to you. A couple of good questions here. Tom, I'll give you term limits because you and I have talked about that. But feminism, as Nancy had brought out, it took America quite some time to come around to recognizing women in full status. What's the background on that?
Well, under the common law, women were citizens, and they were certainly in a better position in the Anglo-American legal system than they were in Europe. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, they were still second-class citizens. Women did have an influence on the public debates over the Constitution. They campaigned on one side or another for or against the Constitution, mostly, as far as we can see, for the Constitution rather than against it. One woman, Mercy Otis Warren, was a leading anti-federalist writer. That is to say, she opposed the Constitution. She later went on to become a distinguished historian. Women voted at that time. Women heads of households voted in New Jersey, and they voted in scattered other locations in America. So women actually helped to elect the delegates to the state ratifying conventions that approved the Constitution. Nevertheless, Nancy is right, they were still very much in a second-class status. And one reason for that, and this is just a matter of historical fact, a very unfortunate historical fact, women died. A man who lived to age 60 during the founding era could expect to have perhaps three wives in succession because women died young. Their physical strength was worn out, producing child after child. They often died in childbirth or died from disease. They didn't have the kind of labor-saving devices they have today. And so the life expectancy of women was significantly shorter than that of men, and their domestic burdens were greater. And so they were not really in the position to participate meaningfully in politics until this is, capitalism. Capitalism was the greatest thing that ever happened for women because it produced the labor-saving devices and the modern medicine to enable women to live as long or longer than men as they do today. To their credit, the founding fathers in drafting the Constitution made it gender neutral. They knew that women voted in New Jersey. They knew that women voted in scattered locations elsewhere. And so they did not put any gender requirement in the Constitution, even though they used the generic he. They didn't put any gender requirement in it. And when the Constitution went for debate, some men complained about that. They said, gee, our president could turn out to be a woman. Horrors, But that was a good decision by the framers. No gender requirement, no religious requirement, no racial requirement. And they left it up to the states. And over the years, the states began to enfranchise women so that a large number of states had already enfranchised them. We already had a woman member of Congress when finally we passed the 19th Amendment that guaranteed all women the right to vote.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's
appreciate
great.
That.
Thank
it
you,
is.
Rob. Yeah, you know, term limits. Term limits are not a new idea. The Virginia Ratification Convention, New York Ratification Convention, North Carolina, et cetera, all wanted to see term limits. As a matter of fact, the 22nd Amendment, which imposed a term limit on the U.S. president, was actually an idea brought up by the Virginia Ratification Convention. So these are not new ideas, and I'd like to see term limits. Most congressmen don't serve that long, but what you end up is with leadership cabals that really control everything. I believe that's happened in the Montana legislature, that just a few individuals ended up controlling the whole thing, and the power accumulates around them, and you can't break into new ideas and new plans and new processes that would be good for the country and good for the state. So term limits. One of these other slippery slope arguments you brought up that was debated in the ratification was debt. Now, New York wanted, and so did Rhode Island, I believe, wanted to see a two-thirds vote in order to borrow money. So they saw the general welfare clause as a slippery slope to accumulating debt. Patrick Henry was concerned about it. So if you have standing armies and the ability to borrow money indefinitely, you will burden future generations. So there were individuals in the ratification debates and in the constitutional debates that were deeply concerned about debt. And I would say that that is that the seeds of those problems have borne out today with over $40 trillion of debt and $2 trillion of deficit spending annually.
Can we... Go ahead, Rob.
If I could just add something quickly. The opponents of the Constitution complained about the General Welfare Clause, which is actually the clause that grants to Congress the power to tax for the common defense and general welfare. The anti-federalists claimed that this amounted to a power basically to spend money on anything. And the advocates of the Constitution said, no, that's not true, that the General Welfare Clause is actually a limit on the taxing power. But what happened was that in the 1930s, the Supreme Court issued two different opinions in which it completely misinterpreted the General Welfare Clause, interpreted it the way the opponents of the Constitution had, to basically say that Congress can spend any amount of money on anything it wants. And that took the cap off. That created the $40 trillion debt. That created the auction of special favors that is Congress today. That is not really consistent with the true meaning of the Constitution.
Yeah, Madison brought this up in the very second Congress because the second Congress wanted to pass a bill to subsidize cod fishermen. And Madison said, if you interpret the General Welfare Clause that to give us the ability to subsidize a cod fisherman, there's no limit to what you'll do under the General Welfare Clause. We'll be funding education. We'll be funding police powers. We'll be funding, the religious duties of helping the poor. You know, and this is exactly where we've gone today, where under the General Welfare Clause, as Rob described, which came under Supreme Court decisions in the 30s, we fund everything. And these were proper powers of the state, not a power of the federal government. And so if you interpret the General Welfare Clause to be able to spend money on anything, and you can borrow money to do anything, there's no scarcity in government, then you end up with debt that we have today.
If I could, Tom, add one quick addendum to that. When the Constitution was being debated, opponents of the Constitution claimed that the federal government would be too powerful. So what advocates of the Constitution did, including James Madison and many others, and this is before the document was actually ratified, is they listed for the public all powers that the federal government would not have. The federal government would not have power over social welfare programs. The federal government would not have power over education. The federal government would not have power over local businesses, nor local roads, nor manufacturing, nor agriculture, nor mining, nor real estate transactions, nor real estate use. All these things that the federal government regulates today were matters that were explicitly represented as outside the federal sphere, and it was on the basis of those representations that the American people approved the Constitution.
You know, it seems like, and I want to get take a break up here shortly and talk about where we're at today with the Constitution, but it seems like these arguments were they were big mountains to overcome. How did the groups come together, Tom? How did the people come together despite what is pretty much fundamental arguments?
Yeah, we'll talk about the great compromises that they came to at the Constitutional Convention. I think that'd be a good place to wrap up.
Well, we like to download information on you. The Church at St. Ignatius has 58 murals on its walls and ceilings. Have you been there? Who painted them? The cook! It was the cook, Brother Joseph Carigano. He had no training as an artist and did it in his off hours. Those are just some of the things that when you get into Glacier Country, you can discover. And we're trying to send you to Glacier Country. This is going on with the Montana Department of Commerce. For 7 weeks, they're giving away a weekly prize package that relates to one of the 7 different Montana travel regions to showcase that culture, activities, history. And this week, it is a giveaway to Glacier Country, a camp kit, a Yeti Camino 35 carry-all tote, 30 feet of battery-powered string lights, stadium chairs, mugs, blankets. That's part of this week's giveaway. All you got to do is head to visitmt.com/giveaway. Visitmt.com/giveaway. There are 8 counties and more than 22,000 square miles of mountain ranges, rivers, valleys, lakes, and forests there. Get to Glacier Country, and the Department of Commerce wants to get you there free. Visit mt.com/giveaway. Finishing up here with Rob Nadelson and Tom McGillivray. Tom is the state senator for the state of Montana here, Senate Majority Leader as well, and Rob Nadelson, constitutional scholar with the Mountain States Policy Center. Where do we want to go now? I kind of want to look at the document and see what's working today and what we might need to change. And go ahead, though.
Well, what I wanted to just point out here is that, again, as we talked about earlier, there's these debates between Federalists and Nationalists and the states' rights and national power. One of the things that was debated is a bicameral legislature or a legislature that wanted the House, Madison and the Virginia plan, wanted the House to be elected popularly by the people. And then the House would elect the Senate. Well, the states' rights guys just didn't like that idea. They did not want to give up their sovereignty, one state, one vote in Congress. So they came up with what was called the Great Compromise. Roger Sherman and Oliver Ellsworth from Connecticut were two delegates to the convention that were strong advocates of this. And the Great Compromise was, okay, the House will be elected popularly, proportionally, and they'll, you know, like Virginia would get more than Delaware, more representatives. And the Senate would have 2 senators representing each state, appointed and elected by the legislatures. So that preserves state sovereignty and state, you know, one state, one vote idea. And it also allowed for democracy and people to be elected popularly to the House. So that was the Great Compromise. And so these are some of the compromises that were achieved at the convention. And one of the things I want to mention here, Tom, and then Rob can weigh in, is that how critical it was to have compromisers at the convention. If it had only been all nationalists there, like Madison and Hamilton, we probably would have had a tyrannical government today, a dictatorial president serving for life. If it was only just Federalists there or states' rights people, we probably would have had too weak a government to govern. But guys like Sherman and James Wilson and so forth brought great compromises that gave the Constitution the great document that we have today. And I would submit that you just can't have arch conservatives or liberals at the legislature. You need everything and in between. Everybody gives a perspective that's important to come to a great decisions and great compromises.
Rob, did you want to weigh in on that? Got a minute.
Well, that's all absolutely correct. And in fact, the final document was full of compromises. One of the most interesting ones was the compromises that led to the method for election of the president. I have a whole speech that I give sometimes explaining how the Electoral College fits in the system of electing the president and how that system was one of the most difficult things that the founders had to work out. But there are compromises all through the Constitution. The provision which says that tax bills have to begin in the House of Representatives, that was a compromise. The length of the terms of office, that was a compromise. The terms of the president's veto, that was a compromise. The grounds for impeachment was a compromise between folks who didn't want any impeachment at all versus those who wanted impeachment for any reason. And so an enormous amount of thought went into it, and also an enormous amount of background of research into what had worked and not worked in other governments. It really is an extraordinary document.
really a great conversation, you guys. Thanks for coming in and doing that. Rob, I know we'll have you back on to talk about the case for a new Montana Constitutional Convention on September 28th. And go to the Mountain States Policy Center, mountainstatespolicy.org, and read up on that, folks, before the 28th there. And State Senator Tom McGillivray, so good to see you again. You're welcome here anytime.
Yeah, thank you for having me in, Tom.
You want to be a guest host next time?
Well,
no, come on! All right. Rob knows how much fun it is. Rob, thank you. Be well,
thanks,
sir.
Guys.
Yep. And thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.